Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
And I am joined by Amor Tolles, who is out with the paperback version of his short story slash novella collection. It's called Table for Two Fictions. The book is available in paperback everywhere, or if you enjoy the hardcovers, you can still pick that up too. Amor's, we've had him on before talking about The Lincoln Highway, which I think is probably one of the five best books I've ever read, and as well as Gentleman in Moscow. But Amor, I was so excited to see the paperback version of this, because that just means the readership expands. But putting together this collection of short stories, I would think that short stories are the thing that really makes writers prove their mettle. People can write novels. You've got a lot of time to expand characters. When you sit down and write your short stories, it's kind of like a chip close to the green. You've got to get that story up and down in a heartbeat. So how does this compare to your fiction writing that is for a full-length novel?
I think your description is a good one, both of the challenge and of sort of the natural narrow scope of a story. I've come to think of it in a way as a short story is like when you sit down in a restaurant and a couple next to you is in the middle of an argument, you know, and they're not even keeping their voices down. And while you're pretending to read the menu, you're listening and you're like, you know, are they married? How old is she? You know, what did he do last night? And who's Tony? You know, you have questions, and you're piecing together quickly what their story is. And just when you're beginning to figure it out, they pay their check and they leave. You know, and you want to follow them out of the restaurant and say, "Wait a second, I've got questions for you too." You know, and that's a short story is like in comparison to the novel. The novel lays out a territory for us, builds an environment, introduces us to characters and their backgrounds, unfolds events, you know, over many, many chapters. A short story, you're just dropped in. And you're dropped in almost as a voyeur, as someone listening, trying to understand who the people are, what the situation is, and it's over before there's any big, long explanation. And I think that's a lot of fun for the reader and for the writer, which is to have this glimpse of time rather than a big construction, and to leave that moment with the reader having to decide what's going to happen to these people now, having witnessed this interaction and gained some sense of what's going on between these people. What do I, as the reader, think is going to happen in their lives going forward? Whereas in the novel, we may wrap that up for you.
And something else I enjoy about short stories, and I've read these from Playboy to New Yorker to short story collections that have been published over the years, it's always interesting to me to see who the narrator is in the story. And you kind of have a little fun with the reader in this, changing it up. Sometimes the narrator is a main character, sometimes it's a character who's not the main protagonist. And so when you did this, did the narrator stay the same as you wrote these six short stories?
It's a good observation. I think that choosing the narrator is, in a way, the most interesting and the most challenging job for me in any story. Knowing what's going to happen and who the people are and when it takes place and where it takes place, that is actually relatively easy for me to pin down, and it's often very instinctive. As soon as I have the idea for the story, I can picture where and when it's happening, and I have a sense of the people. But the decision of who's going to tell the story is, as I say, it's a challenge. And it has enormous impact on the story, because whether that person is the person who things are happening to directly, or is an observer, complete or a member of the family, changes everything about the story. The tone of it, the language you're going to use, the themes that are going to surface. So in Table for Two, one of the things I had fun playing with is over the course of the collection, and the reader doesn't have to be aware of this consciously, but the first two stories are told by an omniscient narrator who knows everything. Then it's two stories by family members describing a spouse who's involved in activities of various kinds. So the narrator is moving closer and closer to the subject. And finally, in the sixth story, the narrator is the person. And I hope that as the reader goes through the collection, sort of at an unconscious level, they get to sort of enjoy the experience of hearing the way in which the stories change depending upon how close the narrator is to the actual events.
six of the, well, the six short stories, and there's also a novella in the book that we'll get to in a bit, but six of the stories either take place completely in New York or New York plays a major role in the development of the story. And so I know you're a New Yorker now, Boston native, but when New York becomes a character and the city becomes a character, it seems like the place was so important for these stories, but the place within New York change, whether it's a restaurant, whether it's an arts house, an art gallery, a theater, a airport. And so sitting down to write this, putting the stories, it seems to me that it almost had a touch of Gentleman in Moscow. You're watching other people's lives that aren't your own through the lens of somebody that doesn't know everything. So when you take New York, put it in the story, did you take pains to say, I'm going to set this scene in the New York Public Library, or did the story come to you first before the actual scenes and the settings in New York?
Yeah, as you point out, I do live in New York, and I'm 60. I've lived in New York since I was 25. But I think, like many Americans, my awareness of New York, you know, predates that, right? From as we grow up watching film and reading literature, we build in our minds a sense of the New York City landscape. And then, of course, I've lived here for 35 years, so it gets more and more particular and specific and rich. But for me, the idea of the story often comes with the location built in or very quickly. As an example, the fifth story in the collection is called The Bootlegger, and it opens in Carnegie Hall. And a young couple is attending Carnegie Hall, sort of as a special, you know, date, as it were. And an old man comes, sits down next to the young man and the couple, and the young man realizes quickly that the old man is recording concert illicitly in the hall. And this is what launches sort of this interaction, the story, and the events in the lives of the young couple and the older man who's recorded the concert. And first five pages of that story are the most autobiographical pages I've ever written in my career, because it's exactly what happened to me and my wife. And we, you know, we had at the age of 30, just, you know, with the kids sleeping through the night, decided to start going out, treating ourselves to a date. We decided to go to Carnegie Hall for a series of concerts, and the old man who had the seat next to us was recording the concert. So every week we went back, there he was, And at the age of 30, I couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe the outlandishness of this guy in Carnegie Hall, of all places, you know, recording classical music. And my mind was spinning with things like, you know, this is not a victimless crime. You know, someone has to defend the right of the composers and the performers. And I began to fantasize about turning him in. You know, I was going to turn him in. That's what I was going to do. And I didn't do that. I did not turn the guy in. But 30 years later, in between A Gentleman in Moscow and The Lincoln Highway, when I was doing some shorter stories, I returned to that night. I thought, oh, you know, it's kind of an interesting moment, this is a starting point for a story, but only in the story. Let's see what happens if the young man does turn the old guy in. And I can tell you that it does not go well for one of the two of them, and I'll leave it to the reader to find out which is which.
Well, so many of the things that make the story move are things in and of themselves that people would probably find mundane in life. That, I mean, we've got Di Domenico, I think I'm pronouncing that right, fragment that's about a piece of artwork. Like you talked about The Bootlegger, Hasta Luego, meeting somebody on an airplane. I Will Survive has to do with marital infidelity. Ballad of Timothy Touchett, I believe that's how you pronounce that, has to do with having trying to write a novel, a struggling novelist trying to write a novel and trying to have the experiences for that. But it almost had an aura of Seinfeld to it, that they can take somebody can take the most mundane thing and turn it into a story. And so did you come upon as you were writing that this is too mundane to make a story about? Because it seems like you knocked it out of the park on all six of these.
Well, thank you very much. I think that the mundane is a great place to start, you know, for short fiction, I think, because it's a gateway into a story that the more mundane it is in a way, the more quickly readers can relate to the circumstance. You know, like, let's say it was, you know, you're on a bus and an old woman gets off the bus and you suddenly realize she's left her purse. You know, what are you going to do? Well, you grab the purse and you jump off the bus, and suddenly you're having an interaction with this old woman who's wandering, walking down the street in an otherwise anonymous city where you don't talk to the stranger sitting next to you. Suddenly you find yourself, you know, engaged, and you take that little moment, as I say, sitting there on the bus, seeing a person get off, realizing they left something behind, is something that we could all imagine or relate to or may even have witnessed. And then it's just a question of beginning to imagine, how far could this go? You know, what, once that guy gets off the bus, you know, maybe he considered for a second keeping the purse, who knows, but once he gets off the bus and he's reached out to her, well, anything can happen. You know, is she suffering from dementia? Was she angry and, you know, because something bad has happened in her life and that's why she forgot it? Does she desperately need the money inside? Did she leave it there on purpose? You know, you start, as a writer, you start to imagine all the different ways in which this small event could unfold. And of course, that's the pleasure of being a writer. That's why those of us who do it love it, is because it's allowing our imagination to consider different courses of human events and what they might mean, how they might change the individual characters. Is it going to be funny? Is it going to be sad? You know, or is it going to be a confrontation? All these sort of theories and questions that in our imagination we sort of go through different, cycle through different versions of what might have happened. And slowly you hone in on, say, yeah, you know, that's the one. This is the right interesting sequence of events to open up the Pandora's box of human life. But, you know, so I'm making all that up on the spot, what I just, right there. That's not in the book. But the point is consistent with the stories in the book. It often is starting with a very simple, relatable thing. You sit down in a hall and there's a guy next to you, you know, a stranger, and you're suddenly interacting. Or in Hasta Luego, where there's a snowstorm at LaGuardia, and suddenly you're standing in line trying to get out of the airport, get onto a new flight, and once again you're in connection with the person in front of you, and conversation begins, and who knows where it goes from there.
I'm chatting with Amor Towles. He is out with his paperback version of Table for Two. It's a book of short fiction, 6 short stories, and a novella. It's available everywhere. And Amor, one of the things, you mentioned The Bootlegger, the first few pages of that book. It reminded me so much, and it spoke to me, because when Hamilton came out 10, 12 years ago, whenever that was, those of us in flyover country can't just go to New York and see it. The show sold out anyways. When it started coming around the country, we started looking for tickets here, and you had to buy a season ticket to every one of these theaters in order to get a ticket just to Hamilton. And so when that happened there, I thought, that wouldn't happen in New York for a Broadway show, but it probably does for performances at Carnegie Hall, right?
That's exactly what happened. It happened to the story, it happened to us. We really wanted to see a particular piano player, and we wanted to have good seats for the performance. And in order to secure those tickets, we had to subscribe to an entire series, so, you know, which my wife was like rolling her eyes at me, like, you know what, I thought we were going, you know, Carnegie Hall one night, you know, now we're going to 4. But that was the way, you know, sort of the backdoor way to ensure that we had good tickets to see this individual. And so, yeah, that becomes a part of the story, too, where the couple keeps returning to the concert hall. And the way that Carnegie Hall works is that when you have a series, you have the same seat. So you will sit next to that same person for each of the 4 nights.
Eve in Hollywood, you've taken a character who was from your first book, Rules of Civility, and told the rest of her story, as Paul Harvey would say, but or at least an extenuation of her story. And it's set in Hollywood in the 1930s, and so, you know, almost 100 years ago. But as you go to research something like that, I think I heard that you did stay at the Beverly Hills Hotel. And so when you're out there, almost a century later, trying to do research for a story set that much earlier, what's that experience like for you?
I tend to the foundation for a lot of my work set in another time is the reading of novels from that period. You know, that my sense of Russia when I wrote A Gentleman in Moscow really grew out of the fact that I had fallen in love with the Russian novel as a young reader, you know, in my late teens, early 20s, reading Dostoevsky, reading Tolstoy, reading Chekhov, slowly over time, building some sort of a sense of what life in Russia must have been like, you know, 80 years ago, 70 years ago. I just kept doing more reading about Russian life, growing out of that interest. And that became the foundation from which I invented the world of A Gentleman in Moscow. Talking about Hollywood in the 30s, you have the added advantage that, yes, we have the Raymond Chandler, novels of Philip Marlowe as a detective in Los Angeles. We have other, works of fiction set in that period, like A Day of the Locust, the great novel about Hollywood at the time and the grittiness of it. So we have sort of a literature of Los Angeles from the 30s that we turn to. But, of course, we have the film, the world of film itself, which as Americans, we know the movies. We remember those movies, Bogart and Katharine Hepburn and Betty Davis, and we can sort of picture the world of the 30s as depicted in film. But also the life of Hollywood became a cultural story in itself. We have a sense of the studio system, of the hotels that the celebrity stayed at, of the ecosystem that surrounded celebrity at the time. So we inherit a lot of information kind of about that time. And I try to use that as the foundation for my invention, rather than going into a library and taking out an encyclopedia. Because I feel that, for me, if I were sort of going through Wikipedia to find references and building that into the story, the reader would be able to tell. The reader could feel that this is sort of a plug-and-play researched, story. And whereas if I can sort of take things that I've learned over time or imagined over time or seen over time and invent from there, I think I have a chance at making something that feels a little bit more organic and that the reader feels like they are really there for the first time with me.
And the complications of that story arise, well, there's plenty of plot twists in it, but the different perspectives you tell that story in, even Hollywood, it's five or six, I think, different characters. And so it seems like everybody that was interacting with Eve was telling their own version of it. And so do you find that you don't trust all of your narrators, or do you trust them all implicitly?
Yeah, well, it's a funny thing. So readers of my book, Rules of Civility, may remember Eve, who is Katie's roommate and best friend, and late in that novel, she leaves New York, having been in an accident that disfigures her. She's in a relationship which has gone south. She doesn't love her job. She abandons New York with the intention of heading home to Indiana, but at the last minute extends her ticket to Los Angeles because she's not the go-home-to-the-folks kind of young woman. And so I for years, I really wanted to go and continue that story. Imagine what happened to her when she arrived in Los Angeles. And right away, my instinct was, because Eve is a very independent-minded and willful and attractive and interesting character, I think, and she's one of these people who hates when someone thinks they know what she's going to do. She'll do the opposite, just to teach that person a lesson, that kind of a person. And, she has a scar on her face from the accident. So my instinct right away was, have her arrive in a city like Hollywood in 1938 is to imagine that how she's going to affect other people. So instead of sort of arriving and saying, I want to tell the story from her perspective and what she sees and what happens to her, what if instead it's told about by the people who meet her by chance and where she has an impact on them? And that in this way that a glamorous woman with a scar who suddenly shows up in town could catch our eye. So it begins on the train. A retired homicide detective has observed her from a distance and been interested in her. He sees her extend her ticket. This fascinates him. Why does the young woman suddenly decide not to get off in Chicago and go to Los Angeles instead? And eventually one morning they're seated together in the dining car and he has the chance to ask her, why did you extend your ticket? And this kind of begins a chain of events where different people interact with her and are interested in her, but then she ultimately has a big impact on them. Now, we do get to see eventually what Eve, the world from Eve's point of view, too. So part of the fun of it is yes, you're bringing to life each of these people who interact with her, and they each have their own tone. They each have their own issues. They each have their own aspirations. Some of them are good, and some of them are bad as people. And so you're sort of discovering that voice for each of those individuals is really a part of the pleasure, trying to articulate a human life through their observations of somebody else to give us a sense of them. And some of them are reliable and some of them aren't, and that's part of the chemistry of the story, too. So it does become like a mosaic. The reader is piecing together the different perspectives, using the different voices to imagine Hollywood at that moment, but also to imagine how this one young woman affects the lives of a handful of people.
Well, it was an absolutely entertaining book of short stories, and then the novella just kept me page-turning. I read that thing in one sitting. The book is called Table for Two, Fictions. It's six short stories and a novella by the best-selling author Amor Towles. He's also written Gentleman in Moscow, Lincoln Highway, and Rules of Civility. Amor, just another fantastic offering from you, and I thank you for joining me to talk about it.
Brian, thanks for having me back. It's always a pleasure.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio. I'm Brian Vakulskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com, and subscribe to our iTunes podcasts. Thanks to music historian Molly Jolly and segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
New York, New York.